From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So when the data journalism blog 24/7 Wall Street released its new study about women last week, the writers picked a headline they knew would get attention, and it had all the elements of good clickbait: the 10 worst states for women. The blog used recently released Census Bureau data to make the list, and the reason we're talking about it today is because Utah ended up in last place. Utah, the blog post read, is the worst state for women. Today in the program, we're talking about the study, what the findings reveal about being a woman in Utah, and whether the study tells the whole picture of the experience. This is a conversation about opportunity and confidence, and of course, culture, too. We're hoping to hear from you today after this news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So we should admit right up front that when we saw the headline on the business media website 24/7 Wall Street last week that said the 10 worst states for women, we took the bait. The site used new Census Bureau data to give a picture of where women fit in the workforce. The data shows that women were paid about 79 cents for every dollar a man made, and it mentioned that this wage gap varies throughout the states. Of course, the real sensational sentence in the study was this one: Utah is the worst state for women. And when you add it all up, the gender wage gap, the number of management positions for women in business, the percentage of women in government and leadership positions, at least according to this study, Utah is somehow there in the bottom. Let me introduce the panel we have today. Susan Madsen is with us, a professor of management at Utah Valley University, the Orrin Woodbury Professor of Leadership and Ethics, and the founder and director of the UVU Women and Education Project. And Professor, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Morgan Lyon-Cotty is back with us, an associate instructor at the Center for Public Policy and Administration at the University of Utah. She's also the local program manager at the university's Hinckley Institute of Politics. And Morgan Lyon-Cotty, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
We have Nylan McBain back with us, the founder of the Mormon Women Project, the author of a new book, Women at Church. She blogs at nylanmcbain.com. And Nylan McBain, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
And finally, Carol Finnegan is with us, CIO at Nelson Laboratories. She's on the advisory board of the Women Tech Council. It's a group that works to promote women in the tech industry. Chair also of the Utah Food Bank's board of directors. And Carol Finnegan, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, okay, so let's begin with the study itself from 24/7 Wall Street. And I wanted to start, Nylan McBain, you and Susan in particular, too. Nylan, you were a little suspicious of the study, that it was just sort of simple-minded, didn't give a full picture. What's the good part of it? What's the, you know, what's the not so good part, do you think, of it? We'll break this down as we go along, but I want to get some sort of initial responses from it. You seemed a little, eh.
Yeah, I think as I read the summary of the study, I became a little bit skeptical of it because of some of the conclusions that were drawn in the narrative portion of the study in the very beginning, which stated point blank that Mississippi is the worst state for women and didn't seem to qualify that in any way. It also said that Louisiana's pay gap is the highest or the most egregious in the country, and yet Louisiana didn't make the list of states mentioned. And so a couple of things like that made me a little bit suspicious that perhaps this report was put together with a particular agenda in mind, or that the data was sliced and diced in a particular way. A third data point that I saw was that Utah is actually has the second lowest infant mortality rate, and that's actually a good thing, meaning that 5 of our 1,000 babies don't survive, and that's actually the second best in the nation. And so it seemed odd to me that with such a positive, strong statistic like that, that we would still make it to the number one place.
What did you make, Professor?
Well, I agree with those points. The suspicion that I had is the generalization that, and I love, by the way, I love living in Utah. I think it's a great place for women. Let me just get that out.
Do you all want to do that disclaimer, by the way?
Yes.
I'm guessing we're going to hear it a few times.
But they lump really the three pieces that you mentioned, the wage gap, which is true, but there's a lot of details to understanding that, the politics,
which we'll get to, by the way.
And the management, that was from census data. We're about 31% when the nation. Those three are true, but to lump, you know, and say Utah is the worst state for women in general, or even for women to work in, to me is just such an overgeneralization from that those data points.
Carol Finnegan, how do you react to, you don't have to react to the particulars of that actual study if you want, but just to the general idea that Utah's way down there in terms of the way it treats women.
I actually came here from Maryland 8 years ago to take a CIO position with Energy Solutions at the time, and I came to Utah for opportunity. So I was surprised to see we were in the bottom of the whole country. And to Susan's point, I would like to see some quantification, some breakdown of careers, education, socioeconomic. So I was a little taken aback.
Morgan?
Did
it confirm what you thought?
I sort of joked with someone. It reminded me of one of those really early Friends episodes where they're all at a funeral, but the men are in the corner listening on the radio to a football game, and when their team loses, one of them shouts, "Now I'm depressed." Because we all sort of know this is happening. We know there's this pay gap. We know that we don't have very many women in leadership, but when that's sort of that sucker punch. And that was sort of my response, was now I'm depressed. And especially here in Utah, where we like to tout that we're, you know, Forbes ranks us as number one for business. We're a very business-friendly state. Come work here. It's really hard to keep up that image when we also have these other reports that are saying, but not for the women.
Okay, so I think one thing, Nylan McBain raises this question in your blog, you raised this interesting question, and I want to get to it. You say this, you say, are the factors in which Utah ranks so low actually the indicators of Utah women's well-being or not? I mean, that seems to be the real question here. So let me just get a sense of what you mean by that. You seem to be asking, okay, the numbers are this, but they're not giving the whole picture?
Well, I think any good researcher will tell you that the whole picture is gained through quantitative data, but it's only rounded out and completely understood through qualitative storytelling. When you actually get out into the lives of the people who you're trying to understand, and that, of course, is one of the things that's egregiously missing in these clickbait reports, is that we don't understand the lived experience that goes into creating those particular numbers. And as Morgan said, that we have a number of reports that have also come out recently stating that I think the Provo-Orem area is the happiest city in the country and a number of things like that that are pointing to something unusual going on in Utah. And so I think to understand how these reports all come together, we have to go to the stories of our people and the stories of our women in particular. And that's the space that I live in with the Mormon Women Project, and specifically collecting the stories of Mormon women. And of course, that cultural dynamic around Mormon women, our doctrine, our expectations, our cultural forces is sort of the elephant in the room, I think, in regards to quantifiable data such as the 24/7 report is presenting us. And so I think in order to fully understand what's going on here, we have to know about the motivations, the life circumstances, the emotions, the cultural and social pressures that are going into women's lives here in Utah.
So let's get to that then. Susan Manson, I want to ask you about, here's an email from Morgan. This is a man, by the way. Men are free to write in, of course, but I just want to point that out. By some measures, he writes in the 24/7 Wall Street study, Utah is a very good state for women. This is something that's been pointed out. The study apparently emphasizes Utah's high gender wage gap, but Morgan points out most of the reasons for the gender wage gap in any state should be traced or can be traced to differences in choices that women make compared to men. They choose to work fewer hours per week, to work in less physically demanding jobs with better working conditions, to leave the workforce while they have and raise children, those kinds of things. This is Morgan's point. Is he right? Do we have to throw that into the mix, this idea of the choices that women are making to be part-time or to go part-time? Do we have to, if we don't take that into account, are we seeing these results as being skewed?
We do have to take all of those things into account in terms of that. I do think when I speak often about these issues, I talk about internal and external barriers. And sometimes we do make choices as women to take career breaks. I have four kids. I took lots of career breaks along the way, and I worked part-time and so forth. So those do influence. But I always note as well that there are those external barriers still in terms of the processes that companies use in terms of deciding pay and some of those other things, and opportunities sometimes women are given. On the internal piece, sometimes the research is very clear that sometimes women don't negotiate as much. And so on the external part, do managers reach out and try and give opportunities even though women don't negotiate? So it's a really, it's hard to just say this is the statistic. There's so many things that really make up those numbers.
If I could jump in here, I think the crux of what we're talking about at this point is, are these numbers the result of women choosing a certain lifestyle, or is the result of women being compelled into a certain socioeconomic position? And there is certainly data and evidence and qualitative storytelling to suggest that women are choosing these particular hours, these particular pay levels, because it suits other factors of well-being. However, One data point that I would point to is that we actually have a higher percentage of women in Utah working than the national average, which suggests that it's not that our women are staying home. We actually have more women working in Utah than the national average, but they're choosing or being compelled to go into lower paying jobs. And for me, in the storytelling that I have been privy to, this is because of cultural pressures around not wanting to appear ambitious and not wanting to necessarily take that time to go and get a PhD or get into a corporate job that has some social mobility built into it. Instead, it's socially more acceptable for our women, when their children go back to school, to get a retail job or to get something that will just sort of occupy them while the children are in school hours. And people make those deliberate decisions, and there are reasons that they make those decisions. But it's that decision that, for me personally, concerns me the most, because I would want to make sure that our women feel the opportunity and feel encouraged to, if they choose, go into one of those socially mobile career making jobs.
I'd like to add that the study covers, you're talking about choice, the study covers women who don't have a choice as well. And so what I took away from the study is women working in jobs that men work in get paid less. They still have the same obligations. They take care of children and families. So for me, it wasn't so much about choices made, it was opportunity. And the women that don't have a choice were paid less whether they chose that or not, you know, whether they made a conscious choice. So to me, it was about leveling the playing field for people who are working in the same job, doing the same task.
One thing that kind of goes between the comments that you two said is, you know, I have spent a number of years working on understanding the education choices of women in Utah. And we do have the widest gap in the nation of bachelor's degrees attainment between men and women. But one thing that really kind of goes between choice but opportunity as well is we have more women in the state of Utah that continue to choose very female-dominated programs to major in. Elementary education, secondary education, social work. Some of these things are the lowest paying jobs. One of the things that I push is that many of those women don't know that they really can go into computer sciences, or that science in general or math or technology are good fields, and so they're limiting themselves in terms of choice. So I think that goes between women's choices themselves and their perception of opportunity. That piece, I think, is just critical in the state of Utah.
I really want to work through the cultural element of all of this as we go along. Morgan, I wanted to give you a chance, though, to sort of respond to what you're hearing so far. Is it a Are they compelled? Is it a choice? Are they? How is culture and society influencing the choices? I mean, how are you seeing this so far?
I think the culture is such an important part, especially when they are young. When young women are deciding whether to go to college, what to major in, if you look at the percentages of women in sort of those STEM majors, the sciences, the computer sciences, we're where the rest of the country was a decade or two ago. So we see that even from the beginning, they're making different decisions. And in Utah, the average age of when we get married, when we start our families, is much younger than the rest of the country. So young people are making these decisions of, you know, who finishes their bachelor's degree, who gets the master's degree out of the husband or the wife. And we see that cultural influence is very powerful there. And especially among those in the LDS faith, it is much more likely that the man will be finishing his degree or going on to graduate school.
I want to ask about, so there are some of the things that you've found, Susan Madsen. Utah's ranked 46th in the nation in terms of women serving in the state legislature. Mm-hmm. Utah's never elected a woman to serve in the U.S. Senate. It's currently one of only 15 states that don't have any women serving in Congress. Utah shows by far the largest gap in the country between male and female college graduation rates. Mm-hmm. Compared to all other states, Utah is in last in terms of the percentage of female students enrolled in post-secondary institutions.
Now I'm depressed. No, these are true statistics, and you've gotten most of those from reports that I've published through
right.
the years.
Right. Yeah. I've got them from Nylan McBain, as a matter of fact, because she's sort of gone through the list here. So you have the 24/7 study, which seems a little sensational and overly simplistic, but these are very particular numbers that are depressing if you're a woman, right?
They are. We are. I mean, I published a series of reports early in 2014 that looked at Utah compared to the nation. The first report was politics. The second one was nonprofits and then business and also education. And on nonprofits, we're right up there in terms of women on boards and so forth, but we're quite low on the rest of them. And you stated some of the political things as well. We do have one of the lowest percentages. We're about 16% of women in our legislature, and the nation is about 24%. So across the nation, it's not equal men and women, but in Utah, we tend to have those wider gaps. We definitely, and I believe that some of that is culture as well, what we've been talking about. One of the things that I
study. What else would it be, though? If it's not culture, what else would it be?
Well, you know, there's a lot of, I think most of it is culture, actually.
Okay.
Because we do have some women stepping up, some leadership. But one of the things I've done a lot of thinking on, and I do national and international research around leadership identity and women identifying themselves, that they have a voice or that they can influence or lead. And I really think that there's a misunderstanding sometimes, especially in the LDS Church. I happen to be LDS myself, between doctrine and culture. And I talk about that quite often. When doctrine says one thing, but we're used to, you know, not seeing a lot of women that step up and lead. We're used to those things in our life. So when young women are growing up, they just don't see that, and they think that that might be inappropriate, when in reality, for me, it's very appropriate for women to have voice, to lead, to influence, and that's what I believe we're here on earth to do.
So it's not doctrine that women stay at home?
Not doctrine. It's a practice.
And can I just say something, Doug? First of all, I do want to credit Susan with those.
That's what I said.
Those are from her reports.
I'm just saying you put them in your blog. And
tried to spread them even farther and wider.
Yes.
But I want to say something about I do believe that it's a cultural manifestation that we're seeing in some of this data. But I think one of the things that we need to back up and discuss in Utah is why is it important for women to be represented in legislature and in our corporate boards. And I think for much of the rest of the country, I mean, I moved here from Brooklyn, you know, it's an assumption, it's a given that you want something approaching 50-50 parity in institutional representation, gender representation. And I don't think that's an assumption here in Utah. And you can say that that's because of church culture. You can say because it's the optics of the LDS Church.
Wait, what do you mean? So we can't just stipulate in this conversation that it's good to have women involved in the business and political part of our community? We're not assuming that in this state?
I would say I assume that. I think everybody in this room would assume that. But I think for here, in this conversation, I think for this state, we may need to take a step back for some people and say, why is it so important for there to be representation from women? Why do women's voices need to be heard in every gathering in which decisions
Doesn't
are being
like made?
Doesn't
that seem like a conversation we would have had in the 70s that
well,
we would have
moved? I'm not commenting on the rightness or wrongness of
actually,
it.
Well, I'm actually writing a brief that'll probably be released in a couple months. I happen to agree very much with you. Whether it's business, whether it's politics, whether it's whatever setting, I don't think we realize, or maybe our leaders or whomever, or women themselves realize how important it is
Absolutely.
To have diversity and inclusiveness in whatever settings. And there's so much research. And so I am working when I get a little more time. I have all the data on putting that together and getting that out. So we have a little bit of a cleaner brief that just says these are this is the business case, whatever setting it is for women.
There's a book coming out by Princeton University Press, actually co-written by a BYU professor, political science professor, that actually goes into some of these studies. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh,
no,
go
you're
ahead.
Fine. No, you're fine.
That quantifies the change and the impact that 1, 2, 3 women can have in a decision-making body. And the decisions change. They quantifiably change.
Right, but that's a whole other show. Yeah. And that's something.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is
that's next week.
It goes back to you'd think we'd be able to just stipulate that women are important in making decisions in corporate communities and religious communities and in political communities. But that's important what you're saying, and that's not so good if we have to emphasize the statement that hey, women are actually good for making decisions.
We need to change, and being a change agent myself and having studied that in my doctorate, it's work. It's work, and it takes strategic effort, especially social change. It can be done, but it's some work.
Morgan, go ahead. I'm sorry.
One of the great ironies for this for me is that when we look at these top 10 worst states, we've got all of these Western states, and they're pretty much very conservative states. But Western states are the states that led the way with women's suffrage and with much of the women's movement. Wyoming was the first state to give women the right to vote, followed very quickly by Utah. We had our first congresswoman out of Montana, the first state senator out of Utah, Martha Hughes Cannon, the first governor out of Wyoming. And I mean, even within the LDS Church, it was very progressive in the way it gave women leadership roles and power in the early history. The way the Relief Society was set up to give women obligations and duties, and that was decades before Seneca Falls. So we do have this element within our history, but somehow it has shifted to now where we are having this conversation about, wait, do people think it's okay for women to be in power?
Why?
I
mean, I know that's such a complicated question, but give me your thumbnail sketch of why is it? What's changed?
Well, within the LDS Church, I mean, it used to be commonplace for women to be giving the kind of priesthood blessings that now we only see men do, blessings of healings and those sorts of things. And that tapered off throughout the history and sort of after the 1920s and 1930s, after a few talks and a few very direct letters, it stopped. And then, after, you know, we had women empowered again, World War I, World War II, they're in the factories, they're fighting, they're doing all these great things. But then in the 1950s, we suddenly have this vision of the 1950s housewife. I should stop talking about history so much. It's fascinating to me, but I'm sure some of the listeners might be dozing off. But we've also
there's an historical component.
There is this historical component, but we also have these really harsh moments within Utah culture in the 1970s with this backlash to the ERA, and then in the 1990s with backlash towards feminism, where there have been these very strong messages where maybe it's not okay for you to be a strong woman, and maybe it's not okay for you to be in that leadership spot.
In terms of education, real quick, I always remind people that actually throughout history, from the time Brigham Young came over and brought, you know, and started the educational facilities, we had more women in post-secondary education and graduating for most of these years, century or more than the United States. And only really in the 90s, when the national averages went up and Utah slightly went down, did we go below the national average in terms of women graduating from college. And it actually, that was in 2001 when that happened. And one quick other thing
is— Wait, so we're headed in the wrong direction that
yeah,
way?
Yeah, we used to have more. The nation went up. We've gone under. But in terms of politics, one quick statistic here that I found was interesting, and it's in one of my briefs, is that we could not find any data in the history other than 1971 in terms of women in the state legislature. But in 1971, we actually had a higher number of representatives than the national average. And then it was really in the 70s and 80s that started switching.
So it seems like that's a lagging indicator, right? So what happened in those decades that discouraged women from going after these positions? Do you have a hunch?
You know, I get asked that through the years, and we just don't have good data on that. People will give reasons, but we don't have. I'm just not going to even guess. But there's a number of things, but we don't have good research that tells us exactly what happened.
I could guess.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you all.
I'm not going to guess on history. I'm just going to look at present day, where we can't even get people out to vote. Mm-hmm. So you look at Utah statistics, you know, aside from the women's issues, we don't have people participating actively in their community, not their church community, but their democratic community. And we have role models that are all men, right? So I just look at what is right now and the portrayal of Utah and due to actions or inactions that are taken. So,
Morgan, I want to take a few calls, but go ahead. I know you were thinking.
Right. So actually, as Susan was saying, we did have these women in the legislature in the 70s, and the numbers were slowly increasing in the 80s and the 90s. And then all of a sudden in the 2000s, we see it start to dip. And except for 2010, when we had another little increase, we're now with 17 women in the state legislature, and it's going to drop because we had 5 women not decide to run for reelection. We're back to where we were in the mid-90s. And for me, one pretty strong indicator for that is that we have seen this move to sort of ultra-conservatism in the mid-2000s, and obviously with the Tea Party in the late 2000s. And the way Utah's nominating process is set up, you have to go through the caucus and the convention. You have to have these Republican and Democratic delegates vote to even put you on the ticket. And we see that in the past couple of conventions, 75% of Republican delegates were men. And they're most likely also to be older men. So I actually spoke with former Governor Olene Walker about this, and she said, you know, it was always difficult as a woman to get through the convention, but now with so many men there, it's harder for women to get to caucus meeting, harder for them to be elected as a delegate. It's almost impossible for women to get through these conventions.
So there's a structural barrier there.
There absolutely is a structural barrier.
It produces a cycle, too, mm-hmm. because to Carol's point, I mean, if we don't see women in those positions, then we're not going to know how to aspire to be in them ourselves. We're not going to—
Role models.
I mean, that's the purpose of true role models is to sort of create, is to do the reconnaissance for ourselves. We see them out there and we imagine what our own lives would be like in that position. They allow us to see what our lived experience might be in that position. And so if we don't have those women role models showing us what that lived experience is, then we can't aspire to that ourselves. And I think if I can just go back previously and guess at one of the reasons why our numbers perhaps dipped, I think that there was rhetoric in the 90s and even early 2000s that caused a perception that women who were dedicated to motherhood had to be either a mother or not a mother. And I think with the advent of technology over the past 15, 20 years.
What do you mean by rhetoric? Where were people hearing this?
Well, we had the talk by President Benson, okay. Ezra Taft Benson, calling women home from their jobs. And I think that there
was. Stuff from the pulpit.
Stuff from the pulpit.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that there has generally been a retrenchment into family values, particularly by the church and perhaps by some of these Western states where people are coming. We need to note, people are coming here partly because they don't have to have dual income families in order to support children in a state like Utah. But I do think that with, you know, one of the things that I love to use stories in order to emphasize is the fact that technology allows us to not be either or these days. We can be both and. And one of the things I think that stories do is show us models for how a woman can be a dedicated mother, but she can also be pursuing something that has some social mobility or some long-term payback, either financially or in self-fulfillment. And that's not no longer sort of the unicorn in the room. It's actually the norm now.
This idea of integration is something you've written about.
Yes.
The women feel like they can't have it both. That they it's hard. They can't conceive integrating being a mom, being with the kids, and then also going to school or and also
that
having
was
a job.
Key, that was actually one of the key. It was probably in the top 10 findings of a massive study we did around the state. It was qualitative and quantitative. But we found, and I just spoke a couple days ago about this, and what I say is they do not see a life of integration. So they in high school, it's all about high school. Then college, it's all about college. And then when that first, sometimes it's at marriage, but often these days it's at that first child.
Yeah.
Then they say
all bets are off.
Yeah,
things
and they
change
don't.
Now?
Yeah, all of a sudden education was so important, and then they say, "Well, now I'm a mom, and so education doesn't fall to second; it falls off their list." And they say, "Someday I will finish," but they can't see a situation. The most shocking data was actually what we didn't hear. We didn't hear things like, "Well, after I had that first baby, then I finished school," or part-time, I can go part-time, or my husband can watch the kids and I can go in evening, or I can do this or that. Nothing. It was all or nothing. And I think that bleeds over into our perception of being a mom and also being involved in the community, having voice, leading, those kinds of things. I think it's just all or nothing in some of the minds of the women here.
Is it fair to say that Mormon women are getting a mixed message from their religious leaders? On one hand, they're saying, intelligence is the glory of God. Go and get an education. Women should be educated. It's really important. But then the other message they might be getting, whether it's direct or indirect, is, but your principal role is being mom.
I just did an interview for the Mormon Women Project with a young woman, and she referenced the time in her life when she dropped out of school to support her husband as an honorable sacrifice. And that was her, in hindsight, sort of regretting that. But that at that time, she was describing her mindset at that time. And I think that that gets to what we're going for, is that there is this idea that, you know, get as much education as you can. But I think we've probably failed our young women in then providing those role models again, those stories of how then you can integrate these parts of your life, as Susan has been talking about.
So let me ask you this. Morgan, let me ask you this question. Do you think that rank-and-file women within Mormonism believe that it is their job, their job is to be in the home, that that's their principal role?
I think a lot, and I would probably say the majority of women do believe that. And you do hear that a lot from the pulpit at the church. We set up the family as the ideal. And I guess for many, many people, that ideal is the mother at home with the children. But it clearly doesn't reflect our reality. As Nylan was saying at the beginning of the program, Utah has a high percentage of women in the workforce. So we also have a high percentage of Mormons, which means a lot of these Mormon women have to be out there. But I think a lot of it is also where you live, your neighborhood, your ward. Sometimes I sort of laugh that I grew up just north of here in Bountiful, Utah, which is known as a very conservative place, and I had no idea it wasn't this progressive little area until I turned 25, because my leaders and my mother and her friends were professors and state legislators and lawyers, and that those were the role models that I had. And so I had that, I could view my future from that scene. You can have that family. You can have that career. And it was a given that you'll be going to college and getting a graduate degree. So I think a lot of it is honestly sort of ward-specific, the message that young women are getting.
That was Morgan Lyon-Cotty, an associate instructor at the Center for Public Policy and Administration at the University of Utah. Susan Madsen is with us, a professor of management at Utah Valley University. Nyland McBain, founder of the Mormon Women Project. And Carol Finnegan is with us, CIO at Nelson Laboratories, a member of the advisory board for the Women Tech Council. And Carol, it'll be interesting to get your perspective sort of outside of the sort of Mormon realm, which is, we're talking a lot of, about that, which I think is crucial, but it'll be interesting to say, what's it like then for a woman outside of Mormonism to play in a sandbox that's all Mormon, right? Or mostly Mormon, or often is anyway. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are asking, why is Utah the worst state for women? It sounds a little sensational, and it probably was a little bit of clickbait. It was the study by the business media website 24/7 Wall Street that was released last week. But when you do add it up, gender wage gap, the number of women in management positions, the percentage of women in government, Utah needs some work. Let's take a few phone calls. Jennifer is with us in Vernal. Jennifer, welcome.
Hi there. Thank you. I heard the man say, well, it's about the choices that women make. My ex-husband makes $300,000 a year, and I make $600 a month. We have a disabled daughter. Who do you think takes care of her? That would be me. Do I get paid for that? No. And I think that's a lot of it. There's no economic value placed on the women's work, quote unquote. When I worked in the oil field, I made perfectly good money. But at home, I don't make any money because we're expected to work for free.
So
a lot of it.
A lot of women nodding here in this room. Jennifer, thank you. 585 West is the number to join the conversation. Carrie writes on our Facebook page, I wonder how much is discriminatory and how much is women's own choosing to remain home with children. When I graduated law school, there were no more women than men in my class. When I moved to Utah and was admitted to the bar, I was struck by how few women there were at that swearing-in ceremony. If women are underrepresented in partnerships at law firms here, it may be due to fewer women competing for those spots. Holly writes, I'm reminded of something a Salt Lake City social worker recently told me. Utah is the only state in the nation where the term patriarchy is generally seen and culturally acceptable and seen as a positive thing. Let's take another call. Jacqueline is joining us in Boston. Jacqueline, welcome.
Hi, Doug. Thank you. So a couple of points and questions for the panel. First of all, I keep hearing from the panel that because women in Utah choose to stay home, sometimes it justifies the metrics that are the result of the metrics that are being used in the study. And I guess my point, and I would push back and say, just because women are choosing to stay home because of cultural or religious motivation is no excuse for a wage gap, a poverty rate, and number of women in the legislature to be reflected as it is in this study. I am a proud member of the LDS Church. I received my education in Utah. I have family in Utah, consider Utah a second home, but am always become appreciative when I visit Utah that I have been able to pursue a professional career for 25 years on the East Coast, because when I come to Utah, either for work or pleasure, there is a palpable and very distinct feeling of suspiciousness, being suspect about motives but because of being a professional woman. I think this comes from having a closed loop of confirmation bias within Utah in the Wasatch Front. And I guess my last point and question, I guess, for Nyland McBain is, at the beginning, Nyland had made the point that, you know, this study had some kind of agenda. And I think all studies, almost all papers have an agenda, right? But that if we got out and talked to the women in Utah, we would see that somehow they're happy. I think it's very important that we acknowledge and potentially agree. It doesn't matter if women in Utah are happy. That is irrelevant. We should not have these wage gaps, poverty rate, you know, inequality. These metrics are what they are, even if the women within the state of Utah would consider themselves happy. And I think that happy designation is fascinating when you also compare the many, many studies that show that that Utah has the highest use of antidepressants by women anywhere in the country. And I have to believe that this study and the metrics that they are measuring are somehow linked to the fact that although women in Utah may say they're happy, there are other objective data and metrics which maybe say, maybe not quite as happy as we like to say or pretend we are.
Right. I want to get to Nyland and you, Professor Manson, on the, all of you, if you want, on this. Thank you very much for that call. First of all, to this idea that blissfully ignorant but happy, I think that was the point she was trying to get there, that it shouldn't really matter. I want to get you to respond to that. But, Professor, I also want to get you to respond to the other part of that as well, whether it's an excuse. The wage gap is an excuse. Yes, they're choosing to be part-time, but that doesn't seem to be getting at the real issue here. Anyway, go ahead, Nyland McBain.
Well, I think I would just say perhaps up until this point in the conversation, I have not stated forcefully enough my personal emotional reactions to the survey. And I do want to make it very clear that I'm not discrediting the survey. I think, as we've established, there is truth in these statistics. And I also want to make it clear that I personally do not subscribe to the idea that that a woman who chooses to stay home for a certain period in her life should be compelled to remain in that particular state for the rest of her life. I think, you know, my entire body of work has tried to encourage women to see the models of this both and paradigm that I was talking about earlier, where if we do choose to stay home with children, and I have chosen to stay home for a couple of years with children, sounds like Susan has, perhaps the other ladies in this room have, that we are living in a time when a woman can pursue things beyond that particular era in her life. And the thing that depresses me perhaps most about this study is that I think it indicates some sort of maintenance of girlhood among all of our women, where they think that they're supposed to be doing something and they maintain that rather than pursuing something that might bring them more personal fulfillment in the long run and take advantage of technology, take advantage of the longevity of life, and take advantage of a supportive community around them. And that is what I particularly decry, that I think is revealed in this study and that I would love to fix.
Just asking for my opinion about all of it?
No, well, in particular to the point that shouldn't matter that they're making these choices to do these part-time jobs. That's not getting to the essence of the problem.
Well, I think the caller had some very good comments. One of the issues that I am most concerned about is, well, first of all, I want to make a quick comment that if a woman has the choice and believes she has the choice to major in whatever major, have a job in whatever, and she chooses to stay at home full time with children, which I've done for many years, got a couple of degrees while I was doing it. I would really hope that we do not look down on that. I am supportive of those choices, but I am supportive of women having voice and understanding that she has those choices, whether that and that she her voice is important in politics or at, in church or at home or whatever, and that she is equal. You know, we are as women equal to men. So in back to the other issue, yeah, part of our conversation has been to just try and explain why the numbers are such, right? That's what we've been talking about. And I like the callers. I mean, that doesn't mean we should excuse some of it, that it really is data that we need to look at and really parse out in terms of what may be women's choices and let them have the choices they want, but what we need to do in terms of businesses or citizens trying to get women to run for office and figure out, because sometimes women don't know they have opportunities. If we were all aggressive or assertive, we would make that path. But that's not natural for many women. And that's the work I founded the Utah Women in Leadership Project last year. And that's what we're doing. Lots of events. Have a big one tonight at UVU called Talk Like a Girl, Understanding Communication Patterns and so forth of Women. But we need to do more in the state of Utah to help women understand why they need to have voice, why they need to run for office. Just be more aware of those things. But back to what the caller said, we shouldn't excuse, especially those wage gap things for equal work, equal pay.
Carol Finnegan, I wanted to get your sense of what is it like? How does do you get a sense of how the Mormon culture, the predominant culture of this state, bears on someone who's a woman who's working in the workforce in Utah that's not Mormon? I mean, does it have, do you see a kind of an external effect here?
The element I see is conservatism. So whether it's political conservatism, religious conservatism, it is a very conservative culture. And being conservative, coming in as an East Coast liberal, as a woman executive, it's very hard to break into, meaning to build a cohort, to build a support network. It's very possible, especially people in high levels of business are very open in Utah to building bridges, building networks. But you have to have a really strong voice when you get here already, because I wasn't going to develop it here. Hmm. I came from Baltimore to Utah with a very strong sense of self, very empowered from my the way I was raised on the East Coast. So there is like a slap in the face when you get here and you're sitting in a room and people just, everyone doesn't contribute and they look to the men to contribute. I've seen that change over the 8 years I've been here, but it was my initial impression when I got here.
But there are, just to put it out there, because I did a big workshop or a big thing on confidence for women, some of those things, well, most of those kinds of things where women don't talk as much as men, especially if there are more men in the room, women don't step forward as much as men, they think they have to have 100% of the skills to get promotion, those things are across the board, not a Utah thing specifically, they're across the board. These are things outside of the United States, inside the United States, but I think sometimes there's just a little bit more here, but I just want to make sure that we
people
understand.
People know this happens elsewhere too.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's. I want to take a call from Representative Jennifer Selig, who's the minority leader for the House of Representatives. Jennifer, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you all for the discussion.
How are you reacting to what you're hearing so far? I mean, some structural issues, some cultural components. Utah's unique in some ways. Utah's not so unique in some ways. I mean, what's your takeaway from what you're hearing so far?
Well, everyone should know that I am a non-LDS woman from Louisville, Kentucky. So I think that absolutely has a bearing on my experience and what I've been able to do here. I've heard a lot of discussion about choice, which is interesting because within our democratic system, we create our institutions and then they create us, and we are bounded by that framework. And until everybody has all the information and all of the same opportunity, I can't really characterize a lot of actions as being choice. I think they're routed or tracked. I can say that the legislature does care about this issue, at least as evidenced by House Bill 90, Women in the Economy Commission, which was a piece of legislation that I ran and was championed by the Speaker of the House as well, Rebecca Lockhart, during this last session. And it created a commission to do a really deep dive on a lot of these issues to take a look at Utah, both from a quantitative and qualitative perspective. So I've really appreciated those comments related to lived experience. And then also see how we fit within the national infrastructure related to this issue, because we do talk about Mormon culture, LDS culture, but this is a problem that is in nationwide. I mean, nationwide, it's what, 78 cents on the dollar?
Yeah.
And the political leadership problem keeps replicating. So, I mean, yes, there's an LDS issue, but there are issues across the country for whatever reason.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate the call. Let me get some final thoughts because we're about out of time here. As you're seeing, I can't tell if you guys think we're headed forward or backward because there's indicators of all of that. Carol, you start.
I think we're headed forward. There are a lot of groups formed that are advocating for women and their voice. There's the STEM Action Center that's trying to change education at all levels. Women's Tech Council. Companies I've been part of that are building women's networks to give women a voice. So in the
so people
years,
are getting a handle of this, and you think they're creating these groups.
And just
these,
this conversation is moving forward.
Yeah. Professor?
I agree, absolutely. I think in the last 5 years specifically, many things have come to the surface. And I speak a lot around the state, and I'll tell you, there's some energy even this past year and hope and motivation amongst people that I haven't seen for a long time. I've lived here about 13 years. And so I just feel like more people are interested. There's more events to help, more awareness. The media is paying attention. I think we're headed in the right direction.
Nana, what do you think?
I would agree that there is a tremendous energy around this subject, around the state, both within the church and without of the church, outside of the church. And I think that that's very encouraging. I think that we, through role models, through storytelling, through the influx of people who are moving into the state, we are gaining a better idea of how our girls and our women can seize all of the opportunities that are available to them, not only to make money, but also to develop their full potential and to create and craft lives that in their longevity are truly meaningful and contributing to the larger community. And so I'm excited to see the quantity and quality of those stories and those representations improving and increasing for my daughters and for all of our young women.
Morgan, let me give you the final word. What do you think?
Politically, I actually have a lot of hope. I think the Count My Vote change to the way we nominate delegates will include more women, will have more primaries.
So deal with that caucus issue you were worried
about,
Yes,
we'll no
right?
longer have this caucus convention system being as strong as it was. We have Real Women Run, which is an organization which helps recruit and train female candidates. And Donna McAleer, who's running for Congress, actually says that was her inspiration. And we recently had 4 congressional debates, and there were three women in those debates, and that is a very strong image. So for me, that is very hopeful that we are moving in the right direction.
Morgan Lyon-Cotty is an associate instructor at the Center for Public Policy and Administration at the University of Utah. Susan Madsen is a professor of management at Utah Valley University. Nylan McBain, the founder of the Mormon Women Project. She's the author of a new book. We should have you on to talk about this, by the way. Talk about your new book. Thank you very much for being
here.
I love you. Carol Finnegan, CIO at Nelson Laboratories, member of the advisory board for the Women Tech Council. Thank you very much, all of you, for being with us. We encourage you to continue the conversation. We're getting a lot of your comments. Sorry we didn't get to as many as I had hoped, but you can continue the conversation. RadioWest.KUER.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.